Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Kristen Espeland. Coming up, we'll learn more about an upcoming deadline for college students in Indiana. First, the federal stimulus package will send billions of dollars to cities and states in the form of tax cuts, Medicare funds, education spending, and construction dollars. But while local governments have a general idea of how much money they will receive, there are still details to be worked out. Gabe Bullard spoke to some local leaders about their expectations for the money.
A significant portion of President Obama's $787 billion plan to rebuild the economy involves literally rebuilding the country's infrastructure. Those are the so-called shovel-ready projects, such as road repairs and school improvements, that mayors and governors outlined for the president last year.
Any time that you're investing in your infrastructure, you're investing in your economy and in the society.
Joe Wise is the business manager for the Greater Louisville Building and Construction Trades Council.
Right now, if you were to aggregate it across all the trades, I would say we're probably right at 9 or 10% unemployment.
Wise says construction is tied to the health of the economy, and since last year, both have been in decline. He says rebuilding the infrastructure will help reduce those jobless numbers. The idea behind the construction spending is that it will stimulate the economy on several levels. People will return to work, paying local, state, and federal taxes, and buying goods and services from local businesses. Then those businesses can hire more employees and so on. The increase in consumer spending would ideally create more of a demand for materials and manufactured goods and for more workers.
It really doesn't matter whether it's for a temporary job or a medium-term job. Of course, there's no such thing as a job that lives forever, but if you can just somehow get spending started up again, then that should help the economy get back on its feet again.
John Vahaley is the chair of the University of Louisville's Department of Economics. He says the basic idea of stimulating through spending should work, if the money is spent right.
It's up to sort of each state and each local government to make the best case it can to the federal authorities on these are the needs that we have that sort of fit the goals of the program.
I feel like I've been given a 1,000-piece picture puzzle. They only sent 250 pieces, so you really can't figure out I didn't get the box cover, so I'm not exactly sure what the end result's supposed to be.
Former Louisville Deputy Mayor Rick Johnstone is now the director of Louisville at Work. The organization is made up of city department heads and elected officials who will oversee stimulus spending in Louisville. Kentucky stands to receive about $3.7 billion from the package, but Johnstone says he's not sure yet exactly how much of that will come to Louisville.
It looks like in the formula side and money that we're pretty sure we're going to get, that there's going to be somewhere in the $200 million range. Could be more.
And it likely will be more. There are also tens of millions of dollars available through competitive grants that can be used for construction and other projects. The stimulus funds will only be available for 2 years. By that point, it's hoped that the economy will have recovered. There's talk of yet another stimulus proposal if the current one doesn't yield the expected results, but economics professor John Vahaley says that shouldn't be necessary if other steps are taken.
I personally think it's probably in the right number, assuming they do something about the ongoing problem of all the bad debt that's still in the financial system. If they don't fix that debt problem, more money is going to have to be spent.
The Treasury Department is putting together its plan to fix the banking system. Vahaley says without functioning banks, there won't be construction and home loans, which means there won't be anything to sustain the jobs created by the current stimulus when the funds run out in 2 years. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
To find out how to track the $3.7 billion coming to Kentucky and the roughly $4 billion going to Indiana, visit our website, WFPL.org. Application deadlines are just around the corner for college-bound Kentucky and Indiana residents who plan to seek financial aid to pay for their education. All new aid applicants are required to fill out the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA. Even though it's a federal form, each state has its own deadline to submit the application in order to be eligible for assistance from the state or individual institutions. In Kentucky, that deadline is March 15. The Indiana deadline is March 10. Rick Howlett spoke with Indiana Youth Institute President Bill Stanukevich about the FAFSA form and other information needed to help foot the higher education bill.
The FAFSA form is the one universal required document that everybody needs who's interested in going to college, pursuing financial aid, including grants and scholarships, applying for loans. Anybody who's attending college and wants to be in a position to obtain money for college must fill out this FAFSA form with the deadline coming up, and is just a, kind of that gold card, that standard piece that you need to get in the game for every other opportunity related to college funding.
Now, with the economy in the shape that it is, if your financial picture changed because it's based on your 2008 income, is there a way that can be reflected when you fill out the form or when you actually apply to a college or university?
Yeah, that's a great point that you raise. When you fill out the FAFSA, you're using your 2008 financial information, your 2008 tax year information, and there could be changes since then. And what people can do is request to have their 2009 information put onto the form. And the way that happens is by going to the college financial aid officers and ask them for what's called a professional judgment. That's the official term, a professional judgment, because you have special circumstances that are different from your 2008 income. So, for example, you've lost your job, or there have been health care costs that your family's had to pay out of pocket. Could be higher child care costs that you're now paying. Could be several other issues related to changes in your family's economic well-being, like the end of child support or the end of alimony payments. These types of changes can be reflected on your college financial aid document. But what you need to do is make the college financial aid people aware of this and really press your case strongly, asking them for the professional judgment and updating this information. If you don't, you very likely will be leaving money on the table. That's right. You'll be leaving money on the table if you don't make this change, Rick. So we really need to have families, really be very direct and communicate openly if they've had these income changes over the last several months.
And this is called, the terminology is professional judgment, correct?
That is correct. You ask them, could you please make a professional judgment based on this new information? My income has taken a hit, or our bills have gone up in certain areas, and I want that information reflected so that my child or me can be eligible for the greatest amount of college financial aid possible.
Bill, is there any money in the just passed stimulus package for college financial aid?
Yeah, post-secondary education is a point of emphasis in this federal recovery bill. For example, the amount of money available for a Pell Grant has gone up by $2,500. The Pell Grant basically goes, if you have been eligible or your student has been eligible for the free or reduced lunch programs in school, you most likely are eligible for a Pell Grant. That's free federal money for lower-income students to be able to go to college. Yet another reason why you need to have the most accurate information on the FAFSA form. There are some changes in how lending would be done, that private lenders would no longer be involved in college funding, that all of that money instead would flow through the federal government. And there also is a significant amount of money through the Department of Labor for especially adults to go on to college. If you're an adult who's lost your job and now you want to go to technical school or maybe earn that associate's degree or otherwise upgrade your skills, the labor departments in Indiana, it's the Department of Workforce Development, will be making many dollars available to help folks go to Ivy Tech and other schools to upgrade their skills. So it's something to keep a close eye on now as the money gets ready to leave Washington and come to Kentucky and into Indiana.
Well, communication is really important here when you're talking to the financial aid officers, because there may be opportunities that you may have not known about, so you should always ask.
You know, that's the bottom line. We hear the media stories, very legitimate, about what a challenge it can be to get money for college. And, you know, the price of college going up and our families being squeezed and not being able to go to college or send their kids to college. I'll tell you what, we hear somewhat opposite stories from our friends who are college financial aid counselors. What they say is more often than not, families leave money on the table, that they don't get the FAFSA in on time, or they don't go have meetings with the college financial aid officers. They don't research local and state and national scholarship opportunities. You know, more often when kids drop out of college, it's for financial reasons, and those financial reasons need not necessarily be there if the family hasn't left money on the table.
That was Bill Stanyakevich, who's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. He spoke with Rick Howlett. More information about student financial aid, including links to the sites mentioned in the interview, is available at our website, wfpl.org. When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with Loretta Ross about International Women's Day. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Kristen Espeland. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks with Zoe Kazan about her debut as a playwright in the Humana Festival of New American Plays. First, International Women's Day is today. With women playing a prominent role on today's political stage, it might seem that the need for a Women's Day has passed. But according to Loretta Ross, the national coordinator for Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, we still have a lot of work to do on issues such as reproductive justice, violence against women, and pay equity. Robin Fisher talked with Ross about her story and the equality issues women still face.
I want to reach back a little bit in your career. Early on, you were one of the first directors of the first rape crisis center in the country.
Yes, that was the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and I was its director from 1979 to 1982. But the D.C. Rape Crisis Center was founded in 1972 as the first rape crisis center in the country. So I was blessed to have been part of the global movement to end violence against women almost at the beginning.
Do you think that society's views and perceptions of rape and victims have changed?
I think society's views towards rape and victims of sexual violence have changed tremendously. I mean, back in the day when we were first getting the center off the ground, if a woman called police and told them that she'd been raped, she got subject to all this interrogation about what she wore and whether her behavior was provocative, basically whether she bought on the sexual assault herself. And now in most jurisdictions, it's improper, if not illegal, to question the behavior of the victim, but in fact to focus the attention, as it should be, on the perpetrator or the rapist. Same ways, this was also before the first domestic violence shelter was open. So at the Rape Crisis Center, we had to really call attention to the fact that all forms of violence against women is wrong, and that rape, domestic violence, incest, child sexual abuse, all of these things were problems in our society, but until we named them and then started building a women's movement to fight them, I don't think we'd be at the same place today. Right now, most of our society appreciates and acknowledges that this type of violence against women and children is wrong. Now, we've certainly got to go a long way more towards stopping the violence, but at least we've got 2,000 rape crisis centers and domestic violence shelters across the country to help the victims of the violence. And I'm convinced that we're raising a new generation of young men and women, because violence can unfortunately be gender neutral, who know that committing interpersonal violence is wrong.
You gave an interview not too long ago where you talked about intersectional theory, and I found that interesting, that how a person is a conglomeration of their gender or their race or their class, which we don't hear much talk of class in this country. We like to think we are a classless society. And I wondered, how do you think that we can acknowledge our individual pieces of ourselves while seeking to establish community?
Well, with intersectional theory, you can think about it as standing in the middle of a crossroads, in the middle of many intersections of different streets going in different directions. And you've got the race street going east and west, and you've got the gender street going north and south, and you've got the class street going catacorner, and on and on and on until you get this whole set of intersecting streets. And each human being has an individual identity that stands at the crossroads or the intersection of those streets. And each of those identities is important to us, and we would be incomplete without them.
I mean, I'm an African-American woman, but I'm also a mother, a grandmother, a college student, a nonprofit worker. I was born in this country, so that makes me an American citizen. But my father's from Jamaica, so that makes me a child of immigrants. I mean, I have all of these identities that are all important to me, and every human being has these intersectional identities, but we're taught to think of ourselves in very one-dimensional ways. Well, for black women, it was obvious because people always ask us, well, are you black or female first? And we couldn't decide which one we were born first. So we were like, okay, maybe I was born black and the doctor hit me on my butt and I turned into a woman. We gave rise to this need to name intersectionality because we stand at that intersection within these multiple identities. But we see it as a gift we've offered to the larger society because we've called attention to the fact that everyone has intersectional identities.
Well, that's one thing that I found interesting about it when I did a little bit more research is we are all a mix of a million different things, and maybe our commonality is in our differences.
It's not that we all have to be the same in order to enjoy the same human rights. That's another way to look at it. The fact is that while we all have the same human rights, we may need something different to protect them based on our individual identities. For example, if every child has a human right to an education, then your audience may understand and appreciate that a blind child might need her books in Braille to enjoy the same rights that all the other children have. That's her intersectional identity coming to play. It isn't that she has special rights. It's because she has special needs that have to have attention paid to them in order for her to achieve the same human rights. And every human being, as I keep saying, has this complex set of factors that have to be calculated in when you're talking about where their human rights are likely to be upheld or where their human rights are likely to be violated.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Loretta Ross, the National Coordinator for Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, about issues of equality for women. Ross will be in Louisville and Lexington today and tomorrow for events related to International Women's Day. For more information, please visit our website, WFPL.org. Zoe Kazan comes from a family steeped in drama. Her grandfather was the famous director Elia Kazan, whose films included On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. Her father is a screenwriter and her mother a writer and director. And Zoe Kazan has made her way into the business as an actress, most recently in the film Revolutionary Road. She debuts as a playwright this week at Actors Theater of Louisville in its annual Humana Festival of New American Plays. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer spoke to her about her play Absalom and asked about her parents' reaction to having her work chosen for the festival.
When you came up with the idea, when you started working on the play mm-hmm. at Yale mm-hmm. and then to now, how did that process go and when did it start to change in terms of its focus?
Mm. Well, it started as a class exercise. So I wasn't really thinking like a writer, I was thinking like a student. Our teacher would have us do exercise, Don Margulies, who wrote Dinner with Friends and Sight Unseen. And he'd have us do certain exercises like put a game into your play, you know, write a song into your play. So I was trying to get it in on time and be good. I think as a result, it wasn't really a play. It was more like a group of dialogue around a theme. I mean, it was a lot shorter. It was only 60 pages. It was sort of like a one-act play. And the idea of the play was like, who is going to inherit this piece of property? And then I finished the class, and there's a playwriting workshopping program at Yale, and my play got into that. And I started working on it with a mentor, and people started saying things to me like, one of the themes of your play is theft, or one of the themes of this character is his repressed anger. And I suddenly realized, like, oh, there's a way of looking at it where it has its own life. what I was writing about was love and manipulation and selfishness. What is the value of selfishness? Is there a justifiable selfish act? What is the creative process? What is creative ownership? What is passed down in a family that is a character trait rather than property? So I started rewriting to what I saw and what other people saw in the play, and characters changed, and I started writing two characters. My intention was to have one character come on, see that the other person was there, and go back inside. And instead, they started flirting. And I was like, oh, God, I got to change that. And then I realized, no, that's who these two people are. And if I'm going to put them on stage together, they're going to start doing that. And it changed my play. So there's a funny mix of, like, when you have to become the analytical writer and the parts where you have to be a vessel and let people speak through you and watch what happens.
The question that probably has come up already is, how much does your family and the background play into this play?
It's sort of a difficult question to answer because there's very little plot-wise and there's very little in the structure of the family that resembles my family. There's some parts that are drawn from my experience, but I wouldn't say that there's any autobiographical impulse in it. But, you know, they always say writers have to write what they know. And I've written a screenplay and I'm working on a new play now, and I find myself sort of looking at it and going, there's no point in me writing something if someone else could have written it.
A lot of times there's Humana plays that have something that's wacky or zany or edgy. This is the place we're talking with. Sorry.
Right.
One of the things that really struck me about your play as well is that it's very Americana traditional.
I can very much respect the writers who write that way.
You mean edgy?
Edgy or zany or political or avant-garde. It's not who I am. It's not what I can do well. And I don't have an impulse to do it. I guess the reason I started acting and why I write is out of the desire to tell true stories. And I don't mean true by factual. I mean true, like, emotionally true. Like Chekhov, Williams, Miller, Inge, Shakespeare. So I was very much trying to write in that tradition, I think. And also the play is classical in its structure. You know, one setting, 24 hours, set number of characters. And it's a stranger plot. A stranger comes.
When we come back, a new event in Louisville may seem like a circus for canines, but its founder sees it as a learning tool for kids. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Kristen Espeland. This Saturday brings the second Animal Gamble Show to Kentuckiana children, offering them a fun environment to learn about responsible pet ownership and interaction with all animals. The Critter Crusaders, kids between ages 6 through 13, are encouraged to showcase their own creativity with skits, games, music, and other activities, and they enjoy educational animal segments from professionals. Susan Sweeney Crum spoke with the creator of the Animal Gamble Show, Shannon Gamble, about the monthly outing and her goals.
The first one was a Bow Wow Blast. We had great interaction with kids of all ages. The show is mainly geared to kids between the ages of 6 and 13, and it is a children's variety show. And kids are actually part of the creative process. We do skits. We have, we're showing videos. Kids can submit videos. Kids can submit ideas for skits to be produced at the show. We have a game show. J&S Entertainment has kindly offered actual game show equipment with the buzzers and the microphones. And it's a lot of fun. And so we have trivia game, our tail wagon trivia game. So kids get called out of the audience to be participants in the game. We have prizes. We do the Bow Wow Boogie. So, you know, you have time out when you hear the Bow Wow Boogie music. You got to get up and do the jig. And it's about an hour and a half long.
And everything has an animal theme?
It's all animal themed. That's right. Everything is about the animals. We have live music, and we're always coming up with new ideas to engage kids creatively in the process to find new ways to entertain, you know, the kids that are out in the audience and to make it interactive with the kids that are in the audience. So kids that come to the show, they have a chance to be educated, as well as they have a chance to be part of the show. And if kids want to be part of the show and the production process prior to the actual show, they can email us through the website and let us know, you know, hey, what would you like to do in the show? You know, what would you like to submit? And then we're also going to make them part of actively creating the newsletter that's going to be done at least monthly, and that's going to be launched on March 14th, the day of the next show. Our new website's going to launch, and it's going to be very interactive as we can get it for kids, because you got to make sure it's safe, of course, on the internet.
Now, you were telling me even about a young girl who's going to be on your show this weekend, or is just a part of your Critter Crusaders?
Yes.
The trainer.
Little Emily. She is a kiddo that contacted me, a Critter Crusader, and she has got such enthusiasm. And she was telling me all about how she is in this process of researching different training methods through her pets, seeing if clicker training, if she's finding that more successful, if positive reinforcement, you know, the behavior training, trying to try out these three different methods, and she's researching which one she's finding to be the best, and she wants to come on the show and talk about that, and she wants to bring both of her dogs, and she also talks about both of her dogs doing silly things at home, and she's got them on video. She submitted it to one of the national shows, so I said we'd be glad to show her video, so kids will be able to do that too, so they can just contact me, and they can let me know, hey, I've got this idea, or hey, I'm checking this out, or can I be somebody that comes on the show and talks about a way that I'm a Critter Crusader? But we're trying to start what we call Critter Crusader crews all across the country as well. And a kid can start a Critter Crusader crew is basically two kids or more that are together, that are making an effort together to help animals. Maybe it's a little group that they start at their school or through their Girl Scout club, or maybe just through some friends, family, cousins, whatever, and they're going to make an effort to help animals in different ways. All of the different ideas that we come up with for ways kids can be Critter Crusaders are going to be posted on the website when it launches on March 14th, and we're going to constantly be updating that and brainstorming with kids out in the community what they can do, because kids automatically think about, well, I can volunteer at a shelter, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to help animals. But there's also a lot of other unique ways that don't automatically spring to mind that kids have brought up about helping animals. There's kids that have talked to me about, you know what, in my neighborhood, we have a couple of elderly folks that are no longer able to take their dog for a walk, you know, so we help out by doing that, you know, and that's a great way to be a Critter Crusader, and they can pass it off between, you know, a couple of kids in the neighborhood. Hey, maybe you'll do it one day, you do it the next.
And this is even going beyond, I guess, your love for animals, but you said you're, by trade and training, you're a child therapist. Mm-hmm. And so this is also
tap into that.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing something that's also making a lasting impact in terms of the kids themselves emotionally,
self-confidence.
And
absolutely. Yeah. You know, and that's what's really cool about the show, because it offers a creative opportunity, but it also it empowers them to help animals, but it also empowers them creatively to get those juices flowing and taps into maybe some of those other areas that they enjoy. I mean, we want them to love animals, you know, but we also want them to get into all the other cool creative processes. And we have different folks in the community that are helping us creatively. We have people that are helping as far as music. We have creative folks that are helping from the production end of skits. We've got different Critter Crusaders at different schools that are being part of the show. We have a little girl from low from Lo that's helping us. We have another little girl, Bug, from No. We got No and Lo, you know. And then we have the Camera Critter Crusaders who've helped us out at the first show. And so we've got some great kids that are getting on board. And what's so cool is they come up with the greatest ideas, and they have this unique enthusiasm that they can bring to it. And I just feed off of it because I love it, because that's what it's all about to me. But yes, I do tap into kind of that that aspect of my training that has to do with engaging kids. As a child therapist, you really have to get out your, you know, every creative tool you can to engage them about different coping skills and that type of things.
The Animal Gamble Show is the second Saturday of each month from 10 to noon. It's at St. Matthew's Elementary School on Browns Lane. Mothers, sisters, fathers, lovers, what do these four have in common? They're all characters and themes in Window, Kentucky writer Nancy Jensen's collection of short stories and essays. From the story of two sisters trying to come to terms with their differences, to the personal story of her longing for a father, Jensen explores themes of love and loss. Robin Fisher spoke with Jensen about her first collection.
I'm curious about the book and why you did a combination of short stories and personal essays. Why not just short stories, or why not just a memoir? Because your essays read as if you were building up to a memoir.
Well, actually, when I started writing essays, I kind of had that in mind, that to do a memoir. But, you know, I had long been a fiction writer, and I wish I could take credit for the mixed genre idea, but I can't. I was approached by Sina Naslund, who is the editor of Fleur-de-Lis Press, and she had been wanting, apparently for some time, to do a mixed genre collection, because those are unusual. And so she knew that I was publishing in both genres and asked me to put something together, and I at first thought, oh, no, it's not possible, because I hadn't even thought about them as a group. But it was a very interesting and provocative and informative exercise to try to bring the pieces together somehow thematically. It surprised me, you know, when I started doing it, how I was visiting certain themes in both the fiction and the nonfiction.
Well, it really does come through in the collection, and some of the pieces almost seem like companion pieces, or sort of the flip side to each other.
I know, it's weird. Nobody was more surprised than I when, you know, I was starting to put them together and realized that.
Is it safe to say that many of your stories came from events in your own life?
Yeah, I think the seed of them, absolutely. And the stories, not entirely, but many of the stories are much, much older than the essays are. And so, yeah, when I was first, you know, being a fiction writer, learning to be a fiction writer, I was drawing, you know, pretty heavily on my own experience. You know, certainly, you know, fictionalizing at the same time, you know, changing aspects of the life. But, yeah, absolutely. I think the concern, you know, certainly the concerns that underlie the stories are from, you know, my own experience.
Well, the ones I married in Photo April 1965, they seem to be companion pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, talk about those two pieces, because they're almost the same scenario through different windows.
Wow, yeah, I'm actually not quite seeing that, I think, quite in the way you must be, you know, the ones I married, that's one that I think, it, you know, adapts, you know, my own experience somewhat, in that, you know, are, you know, two marriages, which I've had, and but the turn at the end of that story, which is an uplifting and surprising turn, I think for modern fiction, you know, it surprised me when it happened. You know, it ends, you know, happily, which is rare for modern fiction. So I'm not quite, you know, the photo April 1965 or 1965 is, you know, about a longing for a father. So I'm not quite seeing the connection.
Well, I guess I saw them both as somewhat of a commentary on mothers.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, all right. I see that point too. Right. About the influence of mothers and the power of influence on mothers and whether or not one breaks away.
And then also the sort of impact of divorce.
Yes, certainly, yeah. See, it helps to have a reader. readers, I know, you know, see things in different terms. From what I see, you know, I can only sometimes sense intuitively when pieces belong together somehow, but then a reader can articulate it much better than I can.
We mentioned just a second ago that a lot of the fiction is older than the nonfiction mm-hmm. writing. And do you think that sometimes writing the fiction makes you look at the events in your life through a different lens?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there were things that when I was younger, I didn't have the capacity to deal with in nonfiction. I needed the distance of fiction in order to have a more balanced view. I needed that distance of fiction, you know, to have the freedom to alter the characters and the situations. Because I think, you know, when you're young, especially, and you're trying to write somehow about the meaningful events of your life, it's very easy to fall into making characters very black and white. You know, there's one, you know, person who suffered and all of the other people have made that person suffer, and you know, life is much more complex than that. And so you know, having that shield of fiction helped me, I think, see not just through the eyes of the character that might be most like myself, but through the other side. And I'm, you know, working towards doing more of that now in nonfiction, but I don't think I was capable of it, you know, 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago.
In the story Ceiling by Chagall, mm-hmm. I think that what really turns that story around, you know, you talked about giving your characters depth, is when she hears Michael on the phone with mm-hmm. his wife.
Yeah.
I think that takes the story to a completely different level than just the story of a young student in love with an older man.
Right.
And that really brought a realism, I thought, to the story that up to that point it was well written, the story had a nice voice, but there was something about it that was like, okay, you know, that's a nice story. But then right there, it really gives the story an immediacy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that when you read your own work?
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when I was going back and putting the collection together, some of the stories I hadn't read in many years. And, you know, I thought I remembered them and, you know, even was thinking to myself, oh, well, no, not, you know, that's not a very good story. And I'd go back and like, oh my, I did that, you know, and it surprised me that I had, you know, had some sophistication of technique that I had not really been aware of. But, you know, I think I have to agree with as far as, you know, that being the turn in the story, because up until that point, the character's trying to hold on to the fantasy, and it's at that point that she begins to realize that nothing is going to come of this, except that it's going to continue to impact her, but, I mean, that there's not going to be a relationship that continues.
Yeah, there was no big turning point for her in that she felt, this is over, I have to run away, or
right.
You know, this is going to be the great love of my life, and he's going to marry me. It sort of confirmed her worst fears in that he doesn't really want to leave his wife,
right?
And yet I don't want to leave him.
Yeah, well, and there's the idea too that she's becoming aware that he's making her, that he's creating her, that it's a kind of Pygmalion.
Right. She's the anti-wife.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not just but the other woman. He is turning her into someone who does all of the things that his wife will not do.
Right. Yeah, and so she's his work of art. And you know, I don't think the male character is aware that the relationship won't go on for long into the future. I think he separates them entirely consciously, but then, you know, unconsciously, he doesn't want to let go of his creation.
Love and relationships, of course, are a big theme in life and in your book. And one of the most interesting is Loving Galahad.
Yeah.
It's lovely and a little creepy at the same time.
Yeah. That's my little dose of whimsy and fun, but yeah, it's disturbing.
Well, you know, do you think that someone who is reading the story who does not have a pet can understand sort of the whole falling in love with your pet?
Boy, that's hard for me to answer because I've never been without a pet, Now I can tell you that I know a few of the people who have read and liked the story and have told me about it. I'm not aware that they have pets, but that doesn't, of course, necessarily mean that they never did. So I don't know how to answer that because I've never had that perspective in life.
Well, you know, because I had a little bit of personal recognition several years ago. I got my first dog, and I mean, you know, it was like a boyfriend.
Yeah, I know, you just become besotted with
them. I'll whisper that into the radio. So I did pick up on that in the story, and I thought to myself, you know, this is why people didn't understand why I wouldn't stop talking about my dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really did. I thought the ending gave it a little bit of a creepiness.
Well, yeah, because it twists it just a little bit further than what people normally, you know, who fall in love with their pets will normally experience. I mean, she's going to sell the house, buy him jewelry. I mean, you know. Well, and I think, you know, it's the husband's bafflement to me that is a quality that I'm fond of in the story because, you know, the husband, you know, they may not have a relationship that is mutually fulfilling exactly in the ways that they want, but he's not a bad guy. You know, he's just a guy. He's just an ordinary guy who's, you know, perplexed. You know, about what this means, and he even as he thinks it's insane, you know, he realizes this cat's coming between him and his wife, and he just wants to, you know, make that stop. And when she says, "Fine, go," you know, like,
yeah, when he realizes that she would actually choose the cat,
over him,
but
yeah, because he was, as we often do in arguments, you know, delivers the ultimatum, you know, believing that he knows the answer to the ultimatum. And gets entirely the opposite response. So.
I'm sure you would get plenty of pet lovers who will nod their heads in agreement. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I'd pick my pet.
Yeah, well, you know, my relationship with my cats has always been better than relationships with men. So
they're always there for you.
There may be, a little bit more truth in there than.
I want to talk about Window. I want to talk about the. Title essay because when I very first started reading Window, I thought, now, you know, this must be the companion piece to Loving Galahad, but it's really not.
No.
And I have to tell you, I was so moved by the end.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, it just was very emotionally powerful in a quiet sort of way. And I want to talk about your I don't want to call them visions because that's not exactly what they were, but do you think that your receptiveness to seeing those who have passed is related to the fact that you spent so much time around older people when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think that that's a very good possibility because since there were so many elder members of our family, and we were very close to them. I mean, they were really my aunts and uncles, and there were obviously a number of funerals. I mean, they're just, you know, I was surrounded by people who were very near their own deaths, though as a child I, you know, didn't think of it in those terms. I can't explain that experience in a rational way, because it's very real to me, and it happened in the way, you know, that, you know, the poet William Blake tried to explain to people, you know, that he saw God put his head in his bedroom window when he was 4 years old. And, you know, if you haven't had that experience, it's hard to explain. Well, you know, it's not a hallucination. It's, you know, perhaps it's a trick of the mind, but it was as real as, as any experience that I've ever had.
Has your mother ever wanted to talk to you about it after you initially told her?
You know, I don't know if she ever has. I mean, I don't think we've really talked about it. Now, we do talk about the family ESP. That's kind of a standing joke, but it's not really a joke between me and my mother, because we do seem to have some sort of mental connection, an emotional connection that, I think a lot of family or members of families have, and closely connected friends. Whereas, you know, I live, you know, quite a distance away from her, and we only talk on the phone about once a week, and I see her maybe three or four times a year. But she will have a profound sense that something's wrong, and will call me, and it will be wrong. I just won't have told her about it. And the same thing, you know, happens the other way. She's had, I think that, you know, described the dream in that piece about my uncle, seeing my uncle appear, my grandfather appear, but he was wearing my uncle's hat. And then the next morning my mother calls me and tells me that my uncle has died. My mother's had dreams like that as well. And I did talk about it with my grandmother. After my grandfather had died, and we were waiting for the birth of my brother's little girl, the sense that he was there, that my grandfather was there, and in fact we brought it up, and she told me she told me her experience, and I had exactly the same experience she remembered standing out in the hallway when my brother came out after the baby had been born, and she said, and then Buddy, you know, suddenly turned like somebody had touched his shoulder. I had never told her that I had seen the same thing, and then I told her then, and so, you know.
Well, that's interesting, because it gives you a strength to draw from, to know that mm-hmm. that there are others in your family that can sort of share that experience without saying, get over it.
Yeah, I think there's actually, I don't think there's anybody in the family that I grew up in that would dismiss the experience. That just seemed always to be somehow a part of our lives, not something that we spent a lot of time talking about. But, you know, I think even in my brother and sister, as much as, you know, we diverge on a number of things, you know, that's nothing they would say was kooky. You know, it just seems a natural, you know, part of who we are in our family.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Kentucky writer Nancy Jensen about her short story and essay collection, Window. Window is published by Fleur-de-Lis Press and available at area bookstores. Fleur-de-Lis Press is affiliated with the Louisville Review and Spalding University. Robin Fisher is a member of the committee for Spalding's Master of Fine Arts in Writing program. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Kristen Espeland. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.